Welcome to the China MENA podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. China's emergence as a major actor in the Middle East changes the strategic calculation for a lot of countries with interests in the region. Not long ago, governments and companies operating in the MENA didn't have to give China that much thought. That has changed dramatically over the last decade. And what does Beijing think is a question that frequently comes up, whether you're talking about trade, investment, security, development, or diplomacy. And this is more complex given the tense relations between China and many advanced economies around the world. Joining us today to give us a European perspective on China-MENA relations is Camille Lons. Camille is a research associate at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, or IISS, and has long been based in the Middle East office in Bahrain, although she's currently working from Taipei. She covers political and security developments in the Gulf region with a specific focus on Gulf countries' economic and political relations with Asian powers and the Horn of Africa. Prior to this, she worked for the European Council on Foreign Relations. She has spent a lot of time thinking, writing, and talking about China and the Middle East. Camille, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Couldn't wait to have you join us. So let's start more big picture by looking at the EU-China relations in general. Over the past few years, Europe's had a reevaluation of its approach to the PRC. We've seen this year the 17+1 formulation of the 17 Central and Eastern European countries that worked with China became the 16+1, with Lithuania withdrawing earlier this year. The EU-China summit in April really emphasized how far apart the two have grown in recent years. So tell us, how does Europe see China both within Europe and globally, and what's driving these perceptions?
You're right. It's been changing quite rapidly in recent years. The fact that European countries have been like looking at China as a challenge increasingly, and we've seen an emerging consensus as well between European countries, which was not the case for quite some time and quite recently, because until recently you had, for example, countries like Germany, who had like quite important economic interests in China and so didn't want to harm the relationship with China. France also had a good economic interest in China, but there was also a geopolitical element a little bit where they were trying to develop this idea of European strategic autonomy away from the US. And so China was also part of that picture. And of course, and you mentioned it, but there are also all the other countries that are a bit more on the margins of Europe's economic and political center of gravity, smaller countries in the east of Europe and the south of Europe that also had some of their issues as well with Brussels, and we're looking at China as a way to attract new investments and to broaden a bit their margin of maneuver towards Brussels by having this new partner. And in recent years, we've seen that evolving. There's been a bit of disappointments and frustrations from some of these countries that were hoping to attract Chinese investments. Some of them also, and as you say, the case of Lithuania, have been subject to pressures and sanctions from the Chinese. And so there has been, like in recent years, really a growing concern about China's footprint in Europe and what that could mean exactly for European unity. And that has been accelerating really with the COVID crisis, and now with also the context of the Ukrainian crisis. At the moment of COVID, that has been the way Beijing has been handling the situation, also supporting disinformation campaigns in Europe on the pandemic. That has really changed the way Europeans were looking at China as, you know, in terms of its reliability as a crisis actor. But also COVID kind of acted as a wake-up call a little bit for the Europeans in terms of they realized how dependent their supply chains were on China and the kind of vulnerability that could create. And so that has only increased with the Ukraine crisis, where you have that realization that the Europeans are framing a bit this crisis as this idea that Europe and its values, the values it defends, are being threatened by the rise of authoritarian powers, whether it's Russia or China. And there is this idea that globalization and trade links and connectivity don't necessarily bring peace and prosperity, but that they can also become a source of vulnerability, especially for democracies. And so there is what the EU High Representative Josep Borrell called the geopolitical awakening of Europe. And that was towards Russia, but I think it's actually the Ukraine crisis is also having a big impact on the way Europeans look at their relations with China as well. And we've seen the Europeans developing some tools and mechanisms to try to respond to that challenge, whether it is some anti-coercion, economic coercion instruments, the Global Gateway Initiative, that is an attempt to respond to China's Belt and Road Initiative, the fact that a number of European countries and the EU as well have published Indo-Pacific strategies. NATO as well mentioned China for the first time this year as a threat in its strategic concept. So you have really like a very rapid evolution of the perception of China and of how the EU and European countries should be responding to that. That said, I would just nuance this a bit as well, because there is still this willingness amongst European countries to avoid getting dragged into a US-China confrontation well. And they have always tried to position themselves a bit as a kind of third party or third position. This at the moment is made a bit harder by the Ukraine crisis, because it has been really reinforcing the transatlantic partnership and then NATO. Some countries, and especially France, Emmanuel Macron was really attached to this idea of a strategic autonomy of the Europeans, and this idea that even if the relationship with the US is better under Biden's administration, you never know what can happen after. And there is still this trauma a bit of the Trump administration that has been a bit of a wake-up call for European countries on this idea that the Europeans need to define really what their interests are and protect their strategic interests themselves as well, without trying not to get caught between a rock and a hard place when it comes to the US-China rivalry.
Sure, that's a fantastic overview. You know, when you're talking about how maybe the promise of China-Europe BRI cooperation underdelivered, it just made me think of a friend I have from Bulgaria who he was doing a research project, and we were talking about 4 or 5 years ago, and he surveyed a lot of people in Central Eastern Europe, and with very general questions, you know, like which country is the biggest source of investment into, you know, your country, which country is the most dominant economic actor, and, you know, really high numbers, like 80-90% were responding China across the board. And then he showed them the actual data, and it was almost all EU. And China was a very minor actor. And I think people were really projecting a lot of, maybe as media accounts or hopes of, you know, these ideas of Chinese largesse were going to be transformative. But, you know, like you're describing, I think what we've seen is it's much more nuanced and complex.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's the same issue that we have in the MENA region as well.
Well, that's exactly where I'm going now, because just looking specifically at China and the Middle East, obviously this is a region that's quite consequential for the EU. So how does China's growing presence in the region affect the EU's interest? Does it change the landscape? And, you know, are people in Europe thinking of China's presence as a threat or an opportunity or something in between the two?
Yeah. I mean, the MENA region is super important for the EU. And that's why also the Europeans are a bit careful of defining their interests independently from the US, because the US has its own set of interests in the MENA region, China as well, but both China and the US are quite far away from what's happening in the MENA region. And so any political instability, any crisis in the MENA region has direct impacts on European countries, It has also the whole issue about migration coming from the region, or refugee flows coming from the region, has been a big element in internal politics in Europe, especially with the rise of populist parties in Europe, and so it has become really like a domestic question, everything related to the MENA region. And on top of that, you have the fact that the EU is still a bit dependent on energy flows coming from the Gulf. They are very dependent on all the trade, like maritime trade routes passing through Suez Canal. You have 40% of the trade between Europe and Asia passing through that waterway. So everything happening in that region is really like directly targeting and having like consequences in Europe. When it comes to what China is doing in the region, how this is really impacting directly their interest. This is a topic that is only now starting to make its way among European policymakers. It's quite a new topic. Until now, the focus was only either on what China was doing in the EU or on what was happening in the MENA region, but there was quite little thinking on what China was doing in the MENA region and how that could affect European interests. And it also depends a lot on each European countries that have their own set of interests. I would say the main kind of concerns would be, the first one is always the economic competition lens. They've been, of course, they have a big economic interest in that region. It's a big market for them. They make important investments. So they look a bit with concern all the areas where China and Chinese company can be competing with European companies. So for example, the French have been pushing back quite a lot on the attempts by Chinese companies to make headways in the automobile in manufacturing industry in Algeria and Morocco, for example, on digital infrastructures. Huawei was competing directly with Finnish and Swedish companies, Nokia and Ericsson, on renewable energy projects, for example, in power plants. German, Spanish, French companies are also in direct competition with the Chinese companies. So you have a lot of areas of potential economic competition of Chinese companies. But it doesn't, I mean, the Europeans don't necessarily see that as like particularly strategic and having like important security ramification. It's one player, it's one competitor among others. When it comes to infrastructures, actually, sometimes the competitors tend to be more the Japanese or the Koreans than the Chinese companies. They don't necessarily compete on the same economic segments than Chinese companies. So I wouldn't say that's one element, but I wouldn't say it's a very important one. Another element where the Europeans start looking at Chinese influence with, you know, with a bit more concerns, is more on China's role as a provider of development finance and development aid in a number of these countries, because the Europeans are the biggest providers of humanitarian and development aid to that region. It's a very big part of their neighborhood policy. It's a big part of also stabilizing the region to make sure that to avoid any spillover effects on their own security. So it's very important. And so they look with a bit of concern, Chinese development finance that doesn't always align with the kind of standards that they have in terms of especially governance or human rights issues, or even in terms of, I would say, environmental standards. So this is something where they look a bit with concern what China is doing, because they fear that this is kind of eroding a little bit the influence they could have in trying to condition the aid they were providing to the region for reforms, economic reforms or governance reforms. And of course, if China is providing this some development support without these type of conditions, it's making it harder to have this kind of negotiations. So there is a bit of that questioning around how this is eroding their margin of maneuver when it comes to influencing a bit the development of the region. Then I would say there is the defense and security sector kind of area where this is more, I would say, the US is the one that has been like really pushing this idea that we need to be more careful about what China is doing in the region, what security ramifications there could be. The Europeans are a bit less concerned than the US on these kind of issues, but they start watching what's happening. They watch especially China's presence around the Suez Canal, all the developments and investments in infrastructures and industrial parks that have been made around that area, because that's a very important area for the Europeans. The French, for example, have a base in Djibouti and in the UAE, so they've been looking quite closely at what the Chinese base in Djibouti was about, and when there was the rumor maybe of a logistical facility in the UAE, they've been also looking quite closely what that could be. But again, they're a bit skeptical in terms of what that could, like how that could really impact their interests directly. They don't really believe, on the contrary of the US, that China is interested or even able to weaponize this kind of presence or influence to try to to weaponize it against European interest. The thing is that the Chinese themselves need that freedom of navigation around the Suez Canal in that area. So it's not in the interest of China to disrupt this in any way. And the Europeans are actually probably more concerned, not really about China, but at the US reaction and on, like, in case of like a US-China escalation, like how that could ultimately impact their interests and their and the freedom of navigation in that area and access to important facilities or infrastructures. So that's the European position. And I would add a last point that people don't usually discuss too much, but it's less about what the impact on the Middle East could be, but more about how China's influence in the Middle East can translate into the Indo-Pacific theater or on international forums, like how China can leverage its influence towards Middle Eastern countries to get support on international stage. We've seen that already. Many of the MENA countries actually have been supporting China publicly on its on the Uyghur issue. They could be supporting it more on Taiwan or on the South China Sea. Some of them have been, for example, also co-drafting or supporting Chinese resolutions in there's one interesting example in the one UN instance that regulates global internet to try to push for reforms in favor of more like regulated internet by governments. So there are these areas, and when it comes to the Indo-Pacific, we see it today with the crisis in Ukraine, but there is this question of where would MENA countries stand in case of like a full-on escalation, and how that would impact European interests in the Indo-Pacific, and we, especially for those who export energy to Asia, and we see already with the Ukraine crisis the kind of issues we could have and the kind of ramifications it could have on other geopolitical theaters than the Middle East.
Okay, so yeah, the part that I thought that was interesting is when you're talking about the developmental challenge, and also how you see a lot of Middle East countries cooperating with China in multilateral forums. And I think these two things are very, very closely connected, because it hasn't really been noticed much yet, but China announced last year this new, there's the Digital Silk Road, there's the Belt and Road, there's the Health Silk Road, and there's all these different initiatives. But last year they announced the Global Development Initiative. And this is something that I'm actually writing a paper on it right now. So I've been thinking a lot these days. But what you see, I think, especially in the Middle East, is there's a lot of issues where Western countries, we have these universal, you know, these presumed universal norms that drive a lot of how we do things, especially in the development sector. And China and a lot of Middle Eastern countries reject this notion that's universal, that these norms are very Western, you know, preferences, whether it's in terms of governance with democracy being the ideal, or human rights, or gender equality, or free media, or any number of issues. A lot of countries in the region don't accept that premise, and China also doesn't accept that premise. And I think what we've seen, especially since the end of the Cold War, you know, during the Cold War, if countries didn't want to get aid or development, you know, from the West, they always had, you know, the Soviet bloc that they could turn to. But the Soviets collapsed and there's only one game in town, and everybody had to try to twist themselves into knots to go to the West. And what we've seen with China, especially since, you know, the BRI was announced, is China's offering an alternative. And it doesn't necessarily mean people like what China has to offer, but they like having that alternative. They like having the choice. And when China says, look, if you, there's no conditionality, if you want money, we'll lend you the money. We're not going to talk to you about environmental protection reports. We're not going to talk to you about, you know, transparency and hiring or any of these things. It makes it really hard for other countries to compete with this. And we've seen, you know, you brought up the Uyghur issue, and I don't think it's that many countries in the, or many people or governments in the developing world necessarily support it, but they're willing to sign these statements to say, look, why shut the door on China and insult them on, you know, something that they consider a core interest, their domestic political conditions, whether it's Tibet or Xinjiang or Hong Kong or Taiwan, if you consider Taiwan a domestic issue, which I don't, having lived in Taiwan for quite a while. But, you know, you can see how a lot of countries look at the way China does this stuff and says, look, that this aligns with our concerns about our own domestic political pressures or domestic development issues. And I think it makes it a much more challenging environment, you know, for, you know, Western agencies to try to convince people that, no, you should do it our way, because our way is, you know, it's better for you. How do you think we meet that challenge?
I completely agree with you. And actually, it's I'm currently writing a paper with one of my colleagues on Gulf aid as well to the region. That is actually, I mean, Gulf countries are actually sometimes bigger investors and providers of development finance than China in many countries of the MENA region. And it poses also the same question to European partners or other multilateral financial institutions or development institutions on how to cooperate with these countries when sometimes they don't always come with exactly the same standards and values attached to the packages. I think that the key for the Europeans when it comes to competing with China or addressing the question of China in the region is also working on the counter narrative that they offer to the BRI, because at the end of the day, it's also a question of narratives. And a lot of the relationship between the Europeans and MENA countries is marked by a history of colonial relations, especially for countries like France or the UK. And so the relationship is very tainted by this past, and it makes European demands when it comes to human rights or governance reforms perceived as being very hypocritical and patronizing by some countries in the region. And so how do you also change some of the narrative that you have without completely changing the values you're promoting? Because the reason why the Europeans are promoting democracy is not just for democracy, but it's because they believe that democracy, rule of law are very important for long-term development and stability. And so if they want to build stability in that part of the world, they believe that it has to pass through also promoting some of these values. So it's not just an ideological question, but there is a way to, there's probably a way to present it and to sell it to these countries and try to revamp a bit the narrative that we are that we put forward when addressing these countries and maybe this narrative of autocracies versus democracies. Is probably not the best one for the Europeans to use when it comes to the MENA region.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's always been a lot of moralizing and a little bit of, maybe ignorance in a lot of Western countries of how we're seen in most of the rest of the world, that will be, we keep putting things like colonialism back centuries in our minds, like, oh, that was so long ago. And, obviously we know people, if you live in countries in the developing world, you've met people who suffered under this. So it's not a distant memory. So when we talk about liberal values and democracy, it's absolutely, I agree, the hypocrisy of it really kind of makes the message of what you're saying, that, long-term stability and the good things that can come of it gets lost in this, really clumsy messaging. But anyhow, back to China and the Middle East. when Europeans are looking at the region, of course, I did a really good job of showing that this region is very important. And I realized the difficulty in talking about Europe as if it's a monolithic thing. The proximity, I think, is really important, as you mentioned, the fact that things that happen in the Middle East bump into Europe very, very easily and can have positive or challenging effects. Are there specific countries that you think people look at where a bigger role for China is especially challenging for European interests?
It's difficult to reply to your question because it actually depends on countries and depends on the interest you're talking about. I would say Egypt is an important one because of its location, because of the Suez Canal, and because it is one of the countries that has received a lot of Chinese investments and loans recently. So there is a bit of this concern of what that could lead to, how that could translate into leverage. And so Egypt would be an important one, but it depends. If you look at energy resources, you would be looking at Gulf states, or when you look at countries where we have a bit stronger security partnership with and to who we transfer some higher level of technologies and equipments in the military domain. So that could be the Gulf states, that could be Egypt as well, actually. When it comes to this question I was talking about the development and long-term impact on stability and in some of these countries, the North African ones are important, but the Chinese footprint is actually quite limited. So the risk when it comes to Maghreb countries is more limited. So yeah, it depends on what you expect, what you're looking at. There is the question of the type of leverage China has in Iran and how in the context of the negotiations of the nuclear deal. Actually, for now, it's been relatively more of a positive impact because it is also with the support of China and potential Chinese investments that we manage also to convince Iran to join the deal in the first instance and potentially the Chinese can play again this role in the current negotiations. But again, what does that mean when a country like China has a quite important influence in a country like Iran that is quite isolated because of the current situation? That could be also an important country to look at. So it really, Turkey is an important one as well, of course, for the Europeans because of its status as a NATO power, because of its location. So that's also like a very, and we see now with the crisis in Ukraine, how Turkey is like using its NATO membership as a point of pressure as well on European countries and playing a bit of an ambiguous role. So in the case of, again, escalation with China, Turkey would be like an interesting player to look at for the Europeans.
So that's perfect, because other than Turkey, I think you inadvertently hit all the points that I was going to bring up myself, because something I think a lot of people don't look at with China in the region, I think, is, you know, this hierarchy of interest that China has. You know, they use this approach, the comprehensive strategic partnerships, or you know, at the top level, and then strategic partnerships the next level down. And different countries get different designations. And you mentioned Algeria, Egypt, the Gulf states, which I'm taking as Saudi and the UAE, and Iran. And those are the five countries that China's designated at that top level. And that's where, you know, its interests are the most multifaceted and deepest, and where you see the most Chinese people, and where they're just in general doing the most stuff, right? Where they're doing more trade and more contracting. And I think the reason why each of those countries are important is because they all offer something extra, you know, like it's not just about trade. Like when to be a comprehensive strategic partner, the country has to be really important regionally as a political and economic actor. It also has to be considered important beyond the region. So, you know, a country like Oman, where China does a lot of trade and energy, is important, but it's not really that consequential beyond the Gulf. Mm-hmm. So they've got to be seen as important internationally, but there's this plus, you know, this extra thing. So the UAE with its logistics, and Saudi with its own global Islam and global energy markets, and Egypt with Suez, you know, all of these things give it an extra motivation to work more closely with those countries. So you can really see how China's engaging more closely with them. And Turkey, I always think it's interesting because there's that tension, right? Like, you know, Turkey's in NATO, and Turkey is got the difficulty with Xinjiang, you know, where the Uyghurs are Turkic people, and Turkish leaders feel compelled to do something about it, but they can't do too much. And, you know, so Turkey, you can see how China is willing to go just almost so to the edge, but there's always something stopping it. So I think that's how I kind of look at China in the region, is looking at those countries and thinking that's where it has the most potential to, you know, be influential. And it could be influential in a meaningful way, like a positive way. It could align, because like I've said, and you've kind of reiterated this, that China's interests basically are for stability in a lot of ways. It's not trying in security realm, at least. So do you think that this means that there are areas where China, you know, Europe could be trying to cooperate or at least coordinate policy in the region on specific issues where China might actually be seen as a helpful actor?
Yeah, of course. Actually, like, the thing is that the Europeans, they see China's influence with a bit of concern, but at the same time, they know that China is not going to go away, and it's very important, and it can be very, you know, helpful player and when it comes to, so I mentioned the JCPOA, which is an obvious one, but in general, when it comes to development finance, the thing is that there are lots of projects where the Europeans don't necessarily have the capacity to finance all the projects, and Chinese companies have the ability actually to bid with, you know, for quite cheap infrastructures to allow some countries that wouldn't have access to these infrastructures otherwise. That's something that is definitely positive. On the question of renewable energy, the region is going to need a lot of investments to develop renewable energy power plants. Actually, when it comes to North Africa and the Gulf, the Europeans are very interested in also developing some of these power plants to provide renewable energy to Europe. So either when it comes to North Africa, they're looking at options to connect them to the European grid, or when it comes to the Gulf, they have been looking at options for exporting hydrogen to Europe from Gulf countries. So there will be a need for like a lot of development of these infrastructures. And it happens that China is the global leader when it comes to renewable energy technologies and equipment, and it has been already involved in some of these big projects in the region. So in that area, for example, there will be a need for Chinese investment and presence as well. There is When it comes to also the fact that China is lending to a lot of these countries, the Europeans have been trying to engage with the Chinese on debt restructuring, for example, with the Paris Club, or more generally, when it comes to development aid, trying to like nudge China into aligning a bit more with some of the European standards. And it is something that is possible. I mean, there's been a bit of a debate in Europe on this, because some believe that this is a very naive approach and that it's actually helping China to get access to this region with the support of European money, because sometimes it's supported by European funding as well, without really making Beijing more cooperative on these issues. But it's still something where like there is a lot of space to try to engage more with China on these issues, because China is just not going anywhere on this. So you need to engage with that infrastructure as well.
Yeah, you know, you made a great point. And I think one of the things that's missing in a lot of the ways people talk about these Chinese initiatives, like the Belt and Road, started, you know, China was sitting on something like $3 trillion worth of foreign reserves, you know, like a decade ago. And around the same time, I think the Asian Development Bank issued this report saying Asia was in need of something like $8 trillion worth of investment infrastructure investment. And the ADB didn't have, you know, the capital to address that. And the IMF didn't, and the World Bank didn't. And, you know, especially in the World Bank and the IMF, there was a perception they weren't very good at that stuff anymore. And then you look at China and how it transformed itself over the past 40 years, you know, how it did solve a lot of development issues. I think you're right. There's definitely something, you know, some lessons to be learned there. And in this, I think there's probably a little room for coordination. How you politically, I think this stuff gets very complicated, but I think, you know, in terms of what makes China an attractive partner, you know, it's stuff like that. I think when people in the Middle East, these underdeveloped countries that have been trying, you know, through Washington consensus prescriptions for decades, and then China comes in and says, look, we got this thing called the Belt and Road. And, you know, here's a picture of, you know, pick a random city from 1975 and here it is today. Wouldn't you like to figure out how they did that, right? So I agree. I think especially on the development index, the development front, this is an area where there should be a little more coordination or cooperation. I guess the last thing, you know, it's early September. Everybody's still wondering. I'm not wondering. I don't think it's going to happen. But people have been saying Xi Jinping is supposed to be at any day now. They've been saying this for weeks. I'm putting my money on December. I'm saying this publicly here. There's no way he's going to be here anytime soon for my money, but I could be wrong. But a lot of this seems to be in reaction to, you know, President Biden's visit to Saudi last month. And of course, the role of the U.S., I think, is the elephant in the room with all of this, right? You know, there's always the speculation that the U.S. is transitioning, its role in the Middle East is transitioning from this dominant one it's played since, you know, Desert Storm to a less, you know, U.S.-centered region, which I think is maybe overstated the way it's being described, but I think there's a lot of truth to it, that the U.S. is considering a different role for the region. Its interests here aren't what they were 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a recognition that it has to maybe right-size where the Middle East is in its foreign policy. Obviously, the Indo-Pacific has been called the priority theater. Does this idea of the U.S. maybe being less dominant in the Middle East inform, you mentioned earlier, EU's strategic autonomy and need to play a more independent role. Does this inform Europe's thinking about the Middle East and how China features in it?
I mean, first to reply to the point on Xi Jinping visit, I hate making predictions, but I'm a bit, I'm quite skeptical about the reports that were saying he would visit anytime soon, because really he's quite busy, yeah, in China right now with all of the issues happening internally. And I think that the priority right now is about the Congress, exactly. So I may be missing something, and maybe actually tomorrow we'll announce that he is in Saudi visiting. I don't know, but I have the impression, and actually the paper that mentioned that, I think said that it was a Saudi source. And I have the impression that the Saudis have a lot of they have a good interest in you know, spreading these kind of rumors, and that's a way of sort of sending messages to to the US. That's the same when a Saudi source said that maybe the Saudi could be selling oil for yuan. I mean, again, I'm not saying it won't happen at all, but there is also an incentive from the Middle East side to inflate a little bit that kind of rumors because it's part of their own political agenda as well.
But, to interrupt here and jump in with point, when the $400 billion Iran deal you know, was announced in the New York Times, you know, completely, you know, ignoring what Chinese, you know, development lending or investment had been the, you know, trending for the past several years before that. But the same thing, you know, all of these stories came from a leak, you know, from an Iranian leak. Could it be that maybe somebody in Iran had something to gain from this story, getting the kind of traction it got? I think you're right. You know, I think the Saudi story was maybe trying to serve a different purpose.
Discuss that with Chinese experts or people who look really from the China's perspective, they are all, they laugh at me when I speak about like a Xi Jinping's visit to Saudi. Like, why would he go to Saudi right now? But again, we'll see. The future will say.
Well, they're supposed to have this summit in December. So he's not going to make two trips to Saudi within a couple of months, right? That's why I say I think he'll be here in December.
Well, we'll see. We can make some predictions and see who wins. But
sure.
No, to, I mean, to come back to your point on, to your question about US engagement in the region and what how the Europeans are looking at that, that's definitely encouraging the Europeans to try to, how to say, strengthen a bit their security, or more like having a more geopolitical approach to the region. But again, I mean, they're trying, especially when it comes to the US-China rivalry, they are trying to use that as a, also a kind of narrative they can sell to Middle Eastern countries, saying, listen, we can be also a third option. Sure. And you don't necessarily have to choose between the two. And so they always position themselves in that kind of like third position. And I guess that's also a bit the spirit behind the recent EU-GCC strategy document that was released. Although I think it's still a very timid, you know, document. And I think that overall, most European countries are not ready to really have like a very strong geopolitical approach to the region. The only one that has been quite proactive recently was France, with the leadership of Macron. Like, he was, I think he was the only Western leader going to the Baghdad summit last year. He was very active in Lebanon when the issues started happening. He was, I think he was the first, I think, Western leader also to start meeting again with Mohammed bin Salman last year, and again, like, being very active this year, inviting him in Paris. So
very active here in Abu Dhabi as well.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So he's been trying to, again, defend a European or French, but he says it's European posture in the Middle East that is a bit distinct from the American one. But apart from France, I mean, most European countries are not ready to really increase their presence in the Middle East right now. They're completely absorbed by the Ukraine crisis. Germany has always been quite reluctant to be like a strong geopolitical player. And right now it is starting to awake on that front, but really absorbed by its eastern side. So I don't think that we're going to see major changes from the European side when it comes to really their implication in the Middle East. But it's something that it's in the making, and at least there is a growing thinking as well in terms of how the Middle East, I hear more in the discussions how they're tying the Middle East also to the Indo-Pacific. And like, they see that a lot of the issues happening, and it was the same for the Ukraine crisis, things happening in other geopolitical theaters have ramifications or can be linked to other regions. And so today with the Ukraine crisis, we see that the fact that Gulf countries are not necessarily ready to step in to support the Western point of view on this issue is having, you know, concrete repercussions on our interests. And so there is this thinking of trying to link a bit more the different regions between themselves, and so link the Middle East a bit more with what's happening in the Indo-Pacific and what could be the repercussions for us as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, the geopolitical muscle has gotten a little flabby for a lot of countries over the past 20 or 30 years, but I think we've all come to the realization we have to start thinking a lot more about world politics and less about, you know, this globalization framework we've used and more about, you know, how geopolitics affects us. Camille, this has been really fun. Very fascinating stuff. Before I sign off, is there anything that you're working on that you'd like to tell us about, or anything that IISS has got in pipelines that's interesting?
Absolutely. For those who are listening to the podcast and who are interested in China and what China is doing and the kind of reach it has, I really recommend you to check the ISS China Connect project that was just released. It's basically an online interactive tool that represents all Chinese connectivity related infrastructures and investments outside of China in up to 173 countries. It's very useful. It's very interactive. You can get information about each of the projects. You can explore their evolution over the past 2 decades. You can also draw correlations between these projects and the recipient countries' digital penetration, for example, or sovereign debt stock or other governance measures. There will be also, of course, essays and analysis that will be published on this website to help make sense of that data. So I think it can be a very useful tool for anyone following China's global lending and investments in the infrastructure sector. And I invite you all to have a look. And don't hesitate, of course, to reach out to us if you want more information or about the project or about the data and the methodology. So the website is chinaconnect.iss.org. And we look forward to your feedback on that as well.
Cool. I actually was playing with it a little bit today before we went on the show, and it is a very fun map. We'll put a link to that in the show page. We'll also put a link to some of your excellent articles that you've written over the years. There was a great one on the Digital Silk Road Initiative that you co-authored with a bunch of people at IISS that was really, really good. There's one that you did for the ECFR a couple of years ago that I also thought was excellent. You had some very good co-authors on that one.
Exactly.
But yeah, we'll put links on to all that stuff on our show. Camille, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much.
Look forward to seeing you. Say hi to Taiwan for me. I missed it. To our audience, thank you for joining us. Follow us on social media, subscribe, review, and rate us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next episode. Thank you.
Produced by Heartcast Media.